Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call our Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. It is March 26th, Thursday. And thank you for being here, colleagues. Just for everyone to know, Senate Bill 316 has been pulled. We need to have some attorneys look at it at the Dash 2 amendments. And so we are moving that over to the next meeting. And we'll see if things are ready then, okay? So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 316. Or I guess I didn't do that. All right. So now we will open a work session, actually, on Senate Bill 159. But I would like to call Paul Cieslak up to explain any amendment that we might have.
Thank you, Chair Moniz Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Paul Cieslak. I manage the communicable disease section for the Public Health Division within the Department of Human Services. We have several amendments to Senate Bill 159, the Dash 2 amendments, which I hope you all have. If I could just explain them briefly. There are several sort of housekeeping amendments to Section 1 of the bill, which basically add some definitions of things like controls, what are controls in an outbreak investigation, what's an epidemic, et cetera. Section 2 of the bill...
Just go slow because we're still finding papers here.
Okay.
Okay. So do you have the... Does everyone have the Dash 2s? Because it looks like I don't think people have the Dash 2s. Well, I do.
I do not.
Okay, so we need to get copies of the Dash 2s for Senator Moore.
Senator, do we have Dash 2?
And that's the ones you're working from, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Because...
You guys might want to share that until we get copies.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's start over going really slow.
Okay. So Section 1 of the bill is basically dedicated to definitions, and we add some definitions in the Dash 2 amendments like control. Control means a person without a reportable disease about whom information is collected for purposes of comparison to a person or persons with the reportable disease. So this is something that we routinely do in outbreak investigations. We compare the people with the disease to people who don't have the disease, and we say, what's the difference between the two? Is it the sick people all ate the potato salad, or the sick people all injected drugs, or to try to determine what's the risk factor for the disease. We also rely on statute or refer to statute for definitions like disease outbreak and epidemic. We clarify that in addition to reportable diseases, diseases that are explicitly listed among those that are reportable, we investigate disease outbreaks or epidemics. So, for example, the most common outbreak that we investigate is norovirus illness. It tends to be a self-limited gastroenteritis. It's not on our reportable disease list because it doesn't typically get diagnosed without us. But it does. It's the most common cause of a gastroenteritis outbreak. So we investigate those. So then in Section 2 of the bill, we're getting to sort of some more substantive stuff. Section 2 was the one that where we're adding that we investigate reportable diseases, disease outbreaks, and epidemics, and require the release of documents, testing samples, other information needed for the investigation. So in addition to sort of getting the basics on each case of a reportable disease, you know, name, age, sex, county of residence, we often need to do follow-up stuff, talk to the doctor about, you know, how was this person exposed, what were the laboratory tests that indicated that the patient had the disease that of interest, and so on. And sometimes we get a little pushback when we're seeking this investigation because it's not explicitly in the statute that we can ask for this sort of follow-up information on our cases. And then I think questions.
I don't.
No.
Yeah.
I think the biggest the thing I got the most questions about at the first hearing was Section 3 of the bill, where we're talking about to whom can the Department of Human Services or local health departments release confidential information regarding reportable diseases. In current statute, that's sharply circumscribed basically to other public health officials, or if the person was sort of willfully violating rules, then we could release it outside of that. We thought that was insufficient in a small number of cases, but the committee had a lot of concerns about sort of blanket authority to release information outside of public health circles. So we went back and thought about this and basically clarified or got a lot more specific about what we were talking about. We're talking about people who may be exposed to the reportable disease, people who you need to talk to in order to get information about the case of reportable disease, and then we sharply circumscribed the situation. We specified criteria for when this could be employed, and I'm fumbling around to find the exact wording here. So we want to specify that it's persons who are exposed, a person with information necessary to assist the department or local public health administrator in identifying other exposed individuals, the individual who is the subject of the information, and then we said you can only release it if there's clear and convincing evidence that disclosure is necessary to avoid a clear and immediate danger to other individuals or to the public generally. So putting those standards in place to make sure that it wasn't the default. We really want the default to be we can't give away identifying information on cases that are reported to us.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Oh, no. He's okay with it. Okay.
I'm okay. I think
this clarified it very well.
I think so.
Anything else you want to say?
Well, I was actually hoping that Dr. Gary Oxman from Multnomah County was... So, you know, Doctors Gary Oxman and Mary Ann Ware, who represent the Multnomah County Health Department, were kind enough to come down, and they have a lot more proximity to situations where you may need to release information outside of public health circles. So I wonder if we could ask
them
to
please
explain.
Come forward and introduce yourself.
I think this is good the way they...
Yeah, okay. And we are in work session.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Gary Oxman. I'm the health officer with Multnomah County and have been in that role for about the past 20 years. I've provided you with written testimony, so I won't go over that in detail. With me, Dr. Ware, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, Mary Ann Ware. Dr. Ware.
And Dr. Ware is one of our deputy health officers, and we have a collaboration where we provide health officer services for the metropolitan tri-counties, Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah counties. Basically, we're here to speak in favor of this measure, and particularly want to address the disclosure components that Dr. Cieslak outlined. We've had some experiences over the years where we have been attempting to manage cases of communicable disease in the community, and tuberculosis in particular, where it is would be highly desirable to be able to disclose to certain individuals that they have been exposed, or certain institutional settings for hospitals, homeless shelters, etc., where it would be really desirable to be able to let people know that there has been a case of tuberculosis. And in most cases, we're able to manage that without revealing the identity of the person. It really isn't pertinent who that person is, but in certain circumstances, it really is helpful to be able to reveal that. And Dr. Ware will describe a specific situation. I guess the couple of points we want to make is that, first of all, the privacy of individuals is extremely important in our credibility in investigating communicable diseases, and the need to disclose the identity of somebody is really quite rare. For example, in the past 11 years, we've had about 535 cases of tuberculosis, which we've managed through Multnomah County. Only in a couple of those instances have we undertaken the step of disclosure of somebody by name. In one case, it was done under a release. In another case, we used the existing law, although, frankly, we really had to stretch the existing laws with our attorney's interpretation to get there. So what we think is helpful here is just having a specific authorization where we do have the authority in those unusual cases to be able to reveal the identity of a person where it's clearly necessary to prevent spread of disease.
Dr. Oxman, I'll tell you an example. When I was working for Clackamas County, we had a client who had TB, and we got a positive back, and then we couldn't find him. So I called Multnomah County Jail thinking maybe that was where he was, and he was, but he had left. He was already released. And I felt my hands were tied that I could not let them know that we had someone with TB that was in the jail system for, I think, 24 hours or 36 hours, and they needed to know so they could contact all the people that had come in contact with that particular case. I went ahead and just said his name because I was so concerned about the health of the other inmates and staff that were exposed. So in that case, when we're trying to track someone down with a diagnosis, it's extremely important.
Yeah. And that's actually a great example, and it's also an excellent segue for Dr. Ware's example as well.
Madam Chair, I guess, and you've always been such a rebel, but but you do point out, because especially with TB, we're dealing with transient populations, and it's a huge concern because it can get out of control relatively quickly. So.
Yeah, Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, that's exactly the issue we're trying to address. And again, what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a clear authorization for when it's appropriate for public health workers to make that disclosure, but make it very clear that the intent of the legislature is to keep those circumstances very narrowly circumscribed and not to have this become a normal part of our practice. So, Dr. Ware, do you want to talk about that situation that we faced?
Yeah. Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. So I wanted to share another tuberculosis story. Just to remind people, tuberculosis is spread through the air. So a person with TB in the lungs coughs, and the germs get dispersed in the air where they can remain for many hours. So the story I have concerns a homeless individual afflicted with alcoholism, and this individual was admitted to a local hospital for various problems. The patient was released. The tests for TB were sent. One of the issues that we face is that this test takes sometimes weeks to come back. So the patient was released before the test results came back. So 3 weeks later, the sputum test was positive for TB. That's a reportable condition, so it gets reported right to the health department. So we became aware of this homeless individual with infectious TB in the lung, but we were unable to find him. So we had a lot of concerns about the places that he might be. For instance, corrections also came in our mind, and we have soup kitchens and homeless shelters and detox. So we decided that both to find the individual and also to protect these places, that we needed to disclose by name if they happened to see him, that we wanted to see him. We didn't necessarily say he had tuberculosis, but the fact that the TB clinic was looking for him probably carried a message. So we consulted with our attorney, and we were able to put like a search out for this individual. What happened was, a couple of days later, he was admitted to a different hospital and diagnosed with TB. So we removed the notification.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Madam Chair, and it's, you have your logistical issues in the metro area, but somebody could be tested in Klamath Falls, and by the time you get the test back, he's in Ontario or Bend. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's... and it, to be on the front end of something like this is vitally important, simply because I'm not sure if we had a massive outbreak that we know how to deal with it appropriately. So,
okay. We have a is work session.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 159.
Senator Cruz moves the dash twos to Senate Bill 159. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and I'll carry the bill, and we'll...
Oh, Madam Chair,
oh,
let me move the bill first, okay? Would that be okay?
We have a lot of people, and we have another big bill coming up.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 159 as amended by the dash two amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 159 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I'll carry the bill, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 159. Thank you very much for coming. Nice to see you again. With that, I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 24. Do we have the people for Senate Bill 24? All right.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kim Hoffman. I'm the telehealth coordinator for OHSU, but I'm here today as the chair of the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. We have some amendments to Senate Bill 24, which you heard in public hearing on February 19th, I believe. These amendments are primarily due to some concerns that were expressed in that public hearing, and our work group reconvened to come up with some changes to our bill, which we believe address those concerns. First of all, Section 2 and 3 of the original bill have been combined into Section 2 by Ledge Council. The major amendments to the bill in subsection deletes subsection 2 and 3 of the original bill. Those two subsections actually listed specific service providers and services that would be covered by reimbursement telematically. And there was some concern expressed by both providers and payers that the list either limited or did not specifically list particular providers, or in the case of the payers, the term "but not limited to" would allow providers to add services that are not currently eligible for payment. So the work group decided the best course of action would be simply to remove the list and replace those lists with language in Section 6 of the bill. Basically, the premise of the bill is that a payer will reimburse for services telematically if those same services are currently covered as eligible services in a plan if they are provided in person. And that's why we decided that the lists were not necessary. The plan actually defines who is eligible and what services are eligible. We also...
Here, because that was a concern. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
We also deleted Section 3-4 of the original bill. That language actually came from Medicare's reimbursement bill, and it is really not necessary in our bill. And it caused confusion among all of us, so I even was confused myself at times from that section, so we chose to remove that one. And we also chose to remove the section that addresses the rule writing by DCHS, since the premise of the bill is that the current plan defines what is reimbursable and what is not. There was some feeling that rules probably didn't need to be written, so we removed that language. Are there any questions?
Colleagues, this is a group, if you remember, this started last session in 2007 with the telemedicine bill, and we weren't able to get it through. And so we had a work group over the interim that worked really hard and came up. There were still some concerns about the language of the bill, and so the whole group got together once, twice, to to try to hammer out an amendment to this bill, and there seems to be no opposition at this point in time. Is that correct, Kim?
That's correct. We've heard no concerns since we put this information out. So,
and you're the only one up here to testify, and I and the payers as well as providers have not contacted me, so I assume it's a go. Any other questions? All right. We have we're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 24.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2s to Senate Bill 24. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 24 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 24 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
This isn't everything I would like, but we have to start at some point, so this is a starting point. We will continue to refine as we move forward in time.
As you remember, Senator Atkinson had a bill, and if you remember, Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson was here, and this doesn't go as far as he would like, but he did buy off on this. We said, listen, sometimes in this process, we don't get what we want at the beginning, but we can eventually get there with time. Mm-hmm. Senator Bates.
Two quick comments. Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson was in my office yesterday. He's about 6'4". I'm going to vote for this. so I'm going to make it pretty clear. But this really is probably where more and more of medicine is going to go. We're talking already in, and we're not considered rural in Medford, of having opportunity to talk to subspecialists in Portland, and even we're even talking about San Francisco, because that's close for us down there, of being able to have an immediate consult on a patient with telemedicine. We're not set for it yet. We have to have interactive stuff. But when you look at what the judicial system is doing right now in this state, that's where I was this morning with the judiciary on a meeting. They are like in the room with you when you're talking to these people. It's real time. It's as easy to talk to them as I'm speaking to Senator Cruz right now. Well, he's hard to talk to, but I mean, you know, from the point of view of being in the presence of the person, it's truly amazing. And I think that's probably where we're going. But it's a first step. That's the right thing to do. Let's try it out here and expand it as the years go by and as we catch up with the technology. So great bill. Appreciate it.
And we do need to know what the costs are going to be and the problems that we foresee. So
absolutely.
Great. All right. So we've moved the Dash 2s.
Got a motion on the bill.
And there's a motion. Is there any further discussion? Will the clerk call the roll on this one?
Senator Bates?
Yes.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Montes Anderson?
Aye. So ordered.
Who's going to carry it?
I'll carry it because
yes.
I've been working on it for years. Okay?
I would agree.
And so I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 24.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
All right. Colleagues, for those who came in a little late, we've removed Senate Bill 316 from the list, and so we're going to go right into I'll open up. Did I close?
Public hearing.
Oh. Yeah, I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 564.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 564 requires certain health care facilities to implement acuity-based classification systems and to maintain nurse-to-patient staffing ratios.
Could I have the list, please?
We need you right now to drive up health.
So I'm not sure who wants to testify first. So I'm going to start with Robert Wagner, Kathy Giroux, Gordon LaFour. And colleagues, this bill, if you remember, we've had, I always either want to say 2,700 2,800.
Earrings?
Yeah, 2,800. We passed a House Bill 2,800 in 2005 regarding nurse staffing ratio. It was very contentious, and it was very arduous, I think, and bloodletting, actually. And so this has been in process for a few years, but there are some nurses who have been working in the interim that want to address their concerns regarding the way the system is structured. So with that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that briefing. And for the record, Rob Wagner, representing the American Federation of Teachers here in Oregon. And I don't think we need 2,800 more hearings. We just need to move the bill. So, yeah. Ha-ha. just a little bit of context. I'm going to keep my testimony very brief in favor of people who are going to talk about the technical aspects and a little bit more of the context for this issue. AFT in Oregon members include nurses and other healthcare professionals, actually thousands of them, and tens of thousands across the country. Safe patient care is a primary concern for our membership, and this is priority legislation for our members here in Oregon and across the country. A little bit of context, last legislative session there was a bill brought, it was House Bill 2416 in the House side, and it was heard in Representative Kotek's committee, and there was a two-hour hearing. And since that time, there's been a great deal of work done out in the community, building support for this issue through community forums and other venues. We look forward to any productive conversation that can happen around this bill, this legislative session. And with that, I'll turn it over to Kathy Giroux to talk a little bit more about the legislation. Thank you so much.
Is this on? Can you hear me?
Good to see you.
Good morning. Happy Thursday, and thank you very much for allowing us to come and testify, and for my colleagues that are with me. I'm the Executive President of Oregon Federation Nurses Health Professionals, Local 5017, which is AFT Healthcare, so I'm a colleague of Rob's here. Been a registered nurse myself for 30-plus years. I heard that PowerPoint is down, so I'm going to have to read a little bit, but I think most of the things I can say...
It's not working.
Because I brought a PowerPoint with me. But
okay.
Most of the things I can say from the heart, in the mind anyways. I preface this with, this bill is all about the safety of our patients. It's not about politics, not about union politics. This is truly about what we need to do to keep our patients safe, which is us too. You will get a packet that will have a lot of things included, including us tracking other states that are also having testimony and discussing similar bills. There's a video in here, and there's several things that will be very helpful. I'm also flashing this book up. This book is very, very important. Safety in Numbers, Susan Gordon. Anybody has a copy of this, they should read it. It really talks a lot about this. So what I am here today is that, you know, my union, my colleagues, and what I think is most nurses, majority of nurses around the country, support safe staffing. And we here are in favor of Senate Bill 564. We think Senate Bill 564 reduces costs, decreases nurse turnover, and saves lives. I mean, what could be more important than that? Okay? RN to patient staffing ratio legislation was enacted in California in 1999. I know there's been a lot of hype about that. There's huge documentation around it. Immediately, the first 3 years it was implemented, 60-plus percent increase in RN licensure down in California. So not only brought in new nurses, it brought many, many, many thousands of nurses back into the profession. You know, you're always talking about, is the nursing shortage, or are we driving people out of the profession? And you'll hear some of that today. Is, you know, the debate is on whether there's a shortage or is it we just can't keep nurses in the profession. There's all kinds of statistical evidence around there related to proper staffing. This bill sets a floor that we don't have right now. So on a given day, my biggest fear is we keep on hearing about a nursing shortage, and the answer will be de-skill. And it's total opposite. The patients are getting more complex, more complicated, very serious. I've seen major changes in my 30-plus years working in this profession. So things aren't getting easier. Things are getting tougher. So that's not the answer to de-skill the profession. Technology is not going to also be the answer to keep patients safe. So increasing nursing levels does not, I think there's always this, you know, thing that it will drive up cost. It does the total opposite. It decreases cost. I don't know if people know at all what the cost is to orient a new nurse coming in, whether it be a new nurse or a nurse coming into a place to work. Well, statistics are the amount in 2003 was somewhere between $60,000 and $100,000. Well, I could say you could probably double that now in 2009. And if you're talking about a nurse who works in the operating room, you could probably triple that. It takes about 6 to 9 months to get a nurse in the operating room up functioning to the level you need them at. So we're talking about millions of dollars that are spent in this country and thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars that are spent with turnover of nurses in the state. And then also consider the bonus money that they now put out there for nurses, $10,000 to $20,000 just to attract them into a facility on top of the money that's spent in orientation. So I want people to know that. In your packet also you'll have is a 22-minute video that really kind of shows some of the things that happen with California in statistics. Patient acuity has increased, as I said. That's not going to go away. I always say you have to almost like win a lottery to come into the hospital at this point. It's not like you can come in the way it used to be. And, you know, we talk about that all the time, and it'll get hotter and hotter, especially with what we see is happening with healthcare right now. We know that when you have sufficient safe staffing in nurses, it decreases all the things that happen to a patient as a result of being in the hospital. Mechanical ventilator infections, pneumonia, UTIs, urinary tract infections, IV infections, central line infections, all these things decrease, if not eliminated, with the proper staffing of nurses. On top of pressure ulcers, all these things. We know a lot about what CMI is going to do. We know a lot about what the connections are going to be. Most of the things as far as fee-for-service and all that will be connected with our ability to provide safe patient care and to either eliminate or avoid having these things happen when patients in the hospital. Just in evidence that from 2007, increasing 10% adequate staffing in a place, so the statistics would be associated 17 fewer deaths per 1,000 discharged patients just by increasing the RN staffing by 10%. Chances of hospital patients surviving cardiac arrest are lower during the night shift because staffing is usually lower in the night. That's absolutely true. I've worked night shift. I'm a cardiac nurse. Low nurse staffing levels are a key cause of 98,000 preventable deaths each year. This is a 2003 statistic, so I'd say it's higher now, not lower. Okay, we have not done better, except I think California. So in essence, what you're going to hear today is you're going to hear about the acuity, you're going to hear about technology, you're going to hear about is there a nursing shortage or not from colleagues that I brought. We believe, we wholly believe, my heart and soul, is in this, that we believe it's time for Oregon to be ahead of the curve on patient safety. And that's what we want you to consider today. House Bill 2800, this follows House Bill 2800 and actually tacks on to House Bill 2800, because House Bill 2800 by itself is not enough, so we don't want to have any more debates about it. It's time for us to really get serious about safe patient care. So thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Now it goes up.
That's fine. I gave you the short version.
My name is Gordon Lafer. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center, and for the last 5 years have been doing research on the impact of nurse-to-patient staffing ratios, both on recruitment and retention of hospital nurses and on the impact on quality of patient care. And this research is nationally, not Oregon numbers, but I think we have the same trends here at home as for the country as a whole. Basically, the statistics on the shortage are a projected large shortage because we're facing the wave of retirees among nurses, with a large number of people due to retire between 2010 and 2020, and primarily the projection is that by 2020 there will be a gap of 20% between the demand and supply of nurses in the country as a whole. However, the surprising fact is that right right now there is technically no shortage because the number of registered nurses who are of prime working age, who do not have young kids at home and who are ready for work but who are choosing not to work in the hospital industry is larger than the entire size of the estimated nursing shortage in the hospital industry. So we will have a problem of retirees coming up. There is, it does make sense to think about that. But right now what we're looking at is people being driven out of the industry, and that if there was a way to improve working conditions within the hospital industry to draw more of those people back in, much of the current shortage statistically could be solved with the number of registered nurses who are already out there, who already exist. When you say, well, what is it that keeps all these registered nurses from working in hospitals? Overwhelmingly, it's not money, although, you know, everybody, every place would like more money, but overwhelmingly, the number one issue is staffing levels and things that relate to staffing levels. Statistically, nurses seem to be one of the most dissatisfied occupations in the country. One in four American nurses say that they plan to leave their jobs within a year. When asked how do they feel at the end of the day, 50% say they feel, quote, exhausted and discouraged, and 26% reported feeling frightened for their patients. 55% of nurses nationwide say they would not recommend a child or a relative or a friend to go into the nursing profession. And nurses make huge sacrifices in order to make this system work, skipping meals and breaks. 51% report stress-related illness. Yet despite this, they can't keep up either in keeping off their own stress or in providing the quality of care that anybody would like for a loved one in the hospital. There are many, many surveys about what is the reason that nurses have, you know, both surveys of people who have left hospital work and those who are working in other professions saying, what would it take for you to come back in? And there's no mystery here, and you don't have to trust me. I mean, all this is publicly available information. Survey after survey after survey finds that the number one issue, both why people have left and what might bring people back in to hospital work, are staffing levels. Mm-hmm. And for this reason, I think it's important to know that the focus on the pipeline, meaning focus on increasing the number of slots in nursing schools or the ability to train more nurses for the future, while it may be an important element of solving this, it is not sufficient because the burnout rates and, for instance, the statistics of people who say, I'm leaving my job within a year, are equal across ages. You have that among very beginning nurses and very senior nurses. And so if all we do is increase the pipeline, increase the number of people going in, and don't solve the problem of working conditions at the hospitals, it's going to be like, I've said, like, you know, having a hole in the bottom of a bucket and you keep pouring water into it and you wonder, why doesn't the thing ever fill up?
Does Oregon have the ability to survey the registered RNs in Oregon specifically so we could see if those trends are what Oregonian nurses would be?
I know a number of nurses
that get out for a variety of reasons, and that would be something that their center... Oregon Center for Nursing, mm-hmm. I'm sure, could maybe help us on that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Of my relatives, six nurses have left hospital work for various reasons. Some of them working in doctor's office. One of them is a telephone nurse for Kaiser. And special duty and so on and so on.
Yep.
School nurse.
Yeah. Yeah, so you see it.
They all work in the hospital to start with, and they've all left.
They all leave.
Yeah. See, I chose public health because I wanted an 8-to-5 job.
Okay. We rest our case.
What nurses report in the survey are the people leave, you know, not only for mm-hmm. the schedule but also for the sense of being able to practice at the level of professionalism that they would like to, and not mm-hmm. not going home worrying about if somebody got the right medication or not, or if other errors were made.
Yes.
The impact on patient care, other people have testified to, and I can as well, is kind of shocking when you read this. One of the worst shocking statistics to me is that 40% of hospital nurses say they would not feel safe having a relative stay in their hospital. I want to just briefly mention the economic cost of not fixing this problem, which is that, and these are not academic numbers nor union numbers, but the American Association of Nurse Executives estimates that the direct costs of a single nurse turnover is $10,000, and they think probably the indirect costs are $50,000. This is not the 9 months to get up to speed in the OR, but simply the the turnover, the replacement cost of having somebody fill in, the recruitment cost, the bonus cost. So there's a very high yeah. economic cost in addition to the cost of patient care for not doing this. Let me say finally, in terms of HB 2800, that I would view this as complementary to HB 2800. For, you know, we have not done a systematic study, but I have been surveying people anecdotally, and from what I have seen, there are places where HB 2800 has produced positive results, but there are many places, particularly in hospitals where there is no nurses union, that the committee meets once or twice a year. There are other places where the management representatives to committees have reported being told by their higher-ups, you can go into this committee, be as creative as you want, do anything as you want, as long as you don't do anything that costs money.
Wow, boxing.
And that, you know, that won't result in anything. So I believe that if what the...
Just a question here. Have you, do you have hospital by hospital how each hospital works?
No, I don't. And that's sort of, so this is not a systematic survey.
Well, we'll have the hospitals coming up, and hopefully they'll be able to help us.
Okay. In terms of the model, I would just say that the model of having ratios set as a floor and then having hospital committees being able to adjust that as needed, hospital to hospital, unit to unit, you know, rural, urban, those differences would be something that could work complementarily and is not competing solutions to each other. Thank you again for the opportunity to be here.
Okay. Yes. Senator Bates and then Senator Morris.
A couple of questions if I could, and I expect you'll have to get back to us later with the answer to these questions, and because they're kind of strange.
Oh.
Okay, I just want to warn you. Okay. three questions, and I like numbers, I guess. Sometimes look at these things. I should warn you, I'm a practicing physician. I'm not sure what practicing means anymore, but I'm doing the best I can, okay? I'd like to know how the ratio, and this is the hospital setting, ratio of nurses to patients has changed over the last 20 years, knowing that the acuity in the hospital has changed too. I understand that, okay?
Okay.
Like, so the ratio was year to year over the last 20 years in Oregon hospitals, if you can find that number for me at all. I'd also like to know what the ratio of administrators to patients over the last 20 years has done. I think I've seen bits and pieces of that. It's an interesting number, and I really want to see that. Okay. We've become much more bureaucratic, and one of the issues I see with my nurses that I work with is they don't have time for patients often because they're filling out forms and trying to satisfy administrative rules and kind of going crazy doing that.
Yeah. So you want ratio of administrators to nurses and administrators
to patients. Administrators to patients. I think you might see, I don't know, maybe it hasn't changed much, but you might be surprised by that number. Maybe I would. Mm-hmm. I'd also like to see the average length of hospital-based careers of RNs over the last 10 years. With that I mean, you know, how long is our nurses staying in the hospital setting in the last 10 years? I'm focusing the last 10 years because of two things. One, acuity has really gone up in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
But wages have finally gone up in the last 10 years, too. 10 years ago, we started this discussion, nurses would go work in a grocery store cheaper and make more money than they could in ICUs. And we've adjusted some of that. So I'd like to kind of see what's going on here.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I'm not as convinced there's a nursing shortage as other people are. I've got nurses coming out of school now that are worried about finding jobs. Okay? And so there is a dynamic there between how much we're producing and how soon they're leaving the profession.
Yeah.
So I'd just like to have an idea of that. And then lastly, I looked at your staffing ratios here on page 4 of 8 on sort of a synopsis of 564. This is something we should talk about, but it's just strange to me. Peds 1 to 3. I mean, there's cases where there's situations where peds of 1 to 5 or 6 is okay because the kids aren't that sick.
Okay.
And the other cases where it's 1 to 1, you know, you can maybe 2 to 1. Okay.
Acuity factor.
As people move through, I delivered babies for 30 years. Yeah. As people move through active labor, 1 to 1, great. Then immediate postpartum, 1 to 2, okay. Then what's postpartum compared to immediate postpartum? How do you staff for those kind of things in a hospital setting is pretty tough, and that's why I kind of like 2008 so well, because it allowed more work going on at those staffing levels. I've sat there with my nurses at 3 in the morning looking at what's happening in our delivery section at Rogue Valley, trying to decide, do we call somebody in, do we not call somebody in, what do we expect to have happen? And it's something that's very dynamic. And that's why mandatory ratios are a little concerning to me. They have some value, but I'm just not sure I'm quite there yet.
Okay.
What I like to see is probably more teeth in 2008. You know, I think some hospitals are probably doing a pretty good job, and others may not be.
She'll give us.
No, I think it is
one.
So that's, Madam Chair, that's just my position on this. Just want to let you know.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bates. Yeah. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What percentage of Oregon nurses does AFT represent?
I'm trying to think. I don't know.
In terms of organized?
I assume most nurses are organized in the state. Of those who are organized, then, what percent
do you think about a
quarter?
Probably
represent?
About
yeah.
25%.
Of those who are organized, probably about a quarter.
About a quarter. Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. It'd be nice, to know from how many are with ONA, because those are our two main ones. Although I worked for Clackamas County, we had our nurses there were part of the union for all employees. We didn't have a separate.
Okay.
Separate.
Could I just, if I could respond to Senator Bates.
It's an interesting
document. Yes.
Most of the data, as you suspected, we'll have to get to you, but some of it I do have some of it, and I think, first of all, the 20-year timetable is the right timetable, because when the origin of this problem really is in the advent of managed care in the early 1990s, when hospitals did two things. One is reduce the number of nurses per patient, and the other is reduce the length of stay that patients stay in the hospital for any given illness, which means that the average patient who is in a hospital bed at any time is sicker, and so what you have is fewer nurses per patient with more acute patients at the same time. By 1996, the U.S. Department of Labor estimated that there had already been a reduction of more than 20% in the number of nurses nationwide. So, hospitals are now saying we can't find enough nurses, but if we're going to diagnose the problem, we need to know it started not by there not being enough people in nursing school, but by a cutback in the employment of nurses in hospitals. So that one piece of data might be responsive.
Can I just add a couple of things? I think when you look at the set numbers, common sense in the acuity is the piece. What we're trying to do is set a floor when you need a floor for safety purpose. And, of course, I understand exactly. I've worked in, I'm mainly in critical care, but I've worked in a lot of backgrounds. I think really what's happened over the last 10 years in particular, I think the acuity has gone way up. And I think the staffing has not been adjusted. I think people are expecting the same people or the same number of people to take care of patients that are so much more complex. And I think, the numbers. I mean, people get stuck on numbers. The acuity is the factor. House Bill 2800, I understand. I was a believer of House Bill 2800. I don't see how to put teeth in that bill. I think under the dynamics we have right now, I think as long as people are stuck in cost constraints and they can't get their heads around the fact of this actually will decrease their cost, House Bill 2800 will leave us in this chasm of we'll all talk about it, but nothing will happen. I don't think we have the time to wait for that to happen. So this bill mainly talks about a floor where you need a floor to keep patients safe, and you can count on that in a particular day. It's the key to keep people working. I think we're going to keep on driving nurses out. Average nurse that I know stays in for 2 years. They get out of school, they get into the hospital setting, they are totally disillusioned by what it is they've been taught. In all their theory they've been taught, they can't practice that. I think technology has just made it very, very difficult because there is all this administrative and people are so caught up in trying to make sure things are charted correctly that it compromises them from when they're at the bedside because they have to make sure government rules, regulations, all this stuff, and it just paralyzes people. And so I just don't see, I understand about House Bill 2800. I think the acuity of patients is going to keep on going up. We don't have the time to deal with that. And I think the biggest thing that would happen is, if we consider this, is we would bring people back in the profession, we would keep people. So people are worried about jobs. I'm just saying that The answer is not to just have agency and per diem nurses making a lot of overtime money to try to plug in when you need them. It's bringing the right kind of staffing in to a facility, set a place on a day-by-day. People go into it, it's the art of love of taking care of patients and making them well. And having pride in that every day, not going home and stressed out and having chest pain because you think you might have just killed somebody because you didn't do something. That's what's happening right now. And so that's why House Bill 2800, I understand, it's not enough. So if you could look at it in terms of that, I would really want you to think about that. So thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? And thank you, Kathy. It's so important for you to bring this issue up because we do have a nursing shortage in the sense
yep.
that we
yep.
need to have more nurses. And I think this just raises the level so that this conversation is not going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much. And
thank
if we have
much.
Some more questions, we'll bring you
thank
back.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. With that, I'd like to call... Grant Higginson, Samantha Owens, and Al Bradbury. Grant, you can go first while the others come in. Well, wait, Grant, let's let Samantha and Al go first.
Okay. You still want me up here, though?
No.
Okay.
Hi. I've just come from work to support Senate Bill 564 to you. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you. I'm Samantha Owens. I am a registered nurse working the night shift at Kaiser Sunnyside on the newly developed cardiovascular medical unit. I care for patients to make sure that they're not having a heart attack or that their hearts are not failing through the night. In the last year, I've seen my entire job change. With the introduction of the electronic medical record in our facility, we've seen a lot of changes to our workflow. And on the night shift, it's really scary. We've even lost ancillary staff. We've had our unit specialists decreased from one for the entire hospital. And nurses have picked up not only this big charting system that's really cumbersome, but we've also are being pulled away from the bedside to answer telephones and let people into the unit. For me, though, this bill is not just about the ratios. Another very significant part of this bill is about the public disclosure. By the hospitals being reporting the amount of staff that they have working with patients to the public, the patients are able to make a more informed choice about who they want to buy their insurance through. As we all know, health insurance and premiums are just skyrocketing. According to the New England Journal of Medicine, yesterday they had an article that suggests that health care is about $12,000 annually per family. And people are becoming more uninsured and underinsured because of the economy. Many people have to make really hard decisions about who they want to get their health care through. And currently, hospitals are not showing prospective patients the full scope of the benefit of their premiums. The hospitals have admitted how many hours you might expect to have a nurse actually at your bedside when you're really your sickest. So what is the cost of health care when you're really sick? When you're having crushing chest pain, do you really want your nurse being monitoring also six other patients who are in the same condition? This bill is purported to increase the cost of delivering health care to hospitals. I saw a reporting that the operating margin has increased 2.3% per year divided by the 500 hospitals in California, and this was in 2003. I believe that the number has decreased to 1.25%, but I couldn't find that documentation, but I think that we can find that. So the cost, what are the cost savings on if that same 2.3% saves the patient's life or keeps the patient from being rehospitalized constantly for a life-changing injury or the cost of a wrongful death? This is not to mention the incalculable savings of the reputation of our healthcare delivery system here in Oregon. And I would like to pose the moral question, are hospitals really in the business to make money, or did they open their doors to take care of patients and improve the lives of the citizens in their communities? To speak of money, it was also reported that hospitals save $331 million in California because of their ratios. According to the Journal of the American Public Health Association, improving how many nurses are providing care at the patient's bedside also produces a significant cost savings. By optimizing staffing levels, there's decreased risk of life-threatening complications such as pneumonia and infections, which hospitals, it costs them a small fortune every year. Hospitals will also save money by decreasing the cost of training their staff in retention. In one hospital alone in New York, by implementing the staffing language in a contract, the hospital was able to decrease the staff turnover from 15.3% to 10.3% in 2 years. This bill improves health care and will improve the health, improve our overall economy by encouraging hospitals not to lay off workers in this bad economy, but to bring back experienced nurses who will work to improve the health care delivery system and the quality of the health care that we're getting. This bill is instrumental in supporting the infrastructure of healthcare in preparation of the much talked about healthcare reform. When the healthcare reform comes, how are the hospitals ever going to be able to keep up with the demand if they're staffed as they currently are, when patients who cannot afford healthcare right now start coming in to be seen? This bill will help ensure that there's staff at the hospital to take care of those patients when they come in when the reform happens. So for me, this bill is not so much about nurses. It's really about the patients. It's about the care we provide to the public that we have dedicated to serve. I really hope that you would please consider passing this bill for the health of our state. And on behalf of AFT, Local 517, thank you for listening.
And thank you for being a nurse, okay?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alexandra Bradbury, and I'm a researcher with Service Employees International Union, Local 49. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 564 and to encourage you to expand this legislation to include all hospital staff who provide direct patient care. I commend you for considering this bill. A growing body of evidence finds that the ratio of hospital staff to patients directly affects patient health and safety. We believe that providing quality patient care takes an entire team of healthcare professionals. Our union represents thousands of hospital workers, including CNAs, transporters, LPNs, technicians, and many others who serve on the front lines of patient care. They answer call lights. They sit by the bedside of confused and disoriented patients. They lift patients in and out of their beds, help patients to the restroom, walk post-surgical patients, deliver patients to and from procedures, assist patients who cannot feed themselves, monitor vital signs, and provide countless other services. These services must be adequately staffed in order for patients to receive quality care, support, and assistance in their time of need. The shocking truth is that there is huge variation among hospitals in the level of staffing they provide to patients. Which hospitals in Oregon are providing patients with the best staffing levels? One might speculate that chronic understaffing would be most often seen in struggling hospitals with modest financial resources, or perhaps in large hospitals with heavy patient loads, or perhaps in less populated areas where qualified staff might be harder to find. However, a look at staffing data reported by 56 of Oregon's acute care hospitals indicates that low staffing levels are unrelated to any of these factors. Some of the most profitable hospitals are staffed most poorly. And some hospitals that are small or see more Medicaid patients often actually staff their facilities better than large hospitals that treat fewer Medicaid patients. And even at large urban hospitals, where patient census is less volatile than in rural facilities, the range in staffing levels is still quite wide. The first graph I've appended to my testimony shows that the 8 largest hospitals in the state, each with 250 beds or more, range all the way from 4.8 to 7.9 full-time equivalent staff per adjusted patient day. The most profitable hospital in Oregon, Providence St. Vincent Medical Center, has the lowest staffing level among its peers, and indeed, as the graph on the next page shows, St. Vincent has the 6th lowest staffing level in the state. On the other hand, the second most profitable hospital in Oregon, Sacred Heart Medical Center, has a staffing level slightly higher than the state median. So there's really quite a range, and it's not particularly coherent. In Oregon and elsewhere, many caregivers are able to address staffing issues directly through their union. So, for instance, at Kaiser Sunnyside, SEIU members work as part of a team through the Labor Management Partnership to determine staffing levels for each unit based on what's best for patients and caregivers. At St. John's Peace Health in Longview, SEIU members work together to set a schedule matrix with strict limits on how many patients each CNA can have. And in their first contract after forming a union with SEIU, workers at Providence St. Joseph in Burbank, California, won language that sets 9 patients as the maximum load for CNAs on day shift. However, many healthcare workers do not have union representation or have been unable to gain staffing language in their contracts. We therefore encourage you to address non-RN staff in this bill by recognizing all direct patient care staff, not only registered nurses, in the whereases of the bill, requiring DHS to establish ratios for CNAs and other nursing assistive staff, and requiring that staffing plans be produced in consultation with all direct care staff through their unions if they have chosen union representation. Thank you.
On your staffing at large graph, and maybe there's no way to know this, but what is the average acuity level in each hospital?
Sure. We did look at it in both with acuity and non-adjusted by acuity. And the large variation in staffing levels you see in these charts is not explained by patient acuity levels. So, for instance, Providence St. Vincent sees a mix of patients that's barely above the statewide average. So adjusting for case mix, their staff-to-patient ratios are still the lowest among the large urban hospitals. I'd be happy to share with you the numbers, both adjusted and not adjusted, and explain to you why we think the unadjusted numbers are most useful.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
This may be a coincidence, or it may not be a coincidence. Another job I've got is looking at the patient mix at these hospitals as far as payers concerned, uninsured, Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial. Okay. And I tell you what, it may be a coincidence, but I could have predicted these without looking at this chart based on payer mix of these hospitals. Those in areas which have a high commercial ratio of patients, low Medicaid, low Medicare, and low uninsured have the lowest ratios. And those that are in areas serving the uninsured and the most difficult patients have the highest ratios. And I'm not surprised by this at all, but it may just be a coincidence. I'm not saying that's the cause. I really don't know for sure. But if you lined up payer mix against this, you might be interested in seeing the results. You have to drop out the part, you know, the A and B hospitals are a different category. But if you look at the DRG hospitals, look at payer mix, you may find that could be driving this equation the most. Okay. Can I have a follow-up question with Samantha? Hi. I know you've been working all night. You're probably exhausted, and I'm scared to ask you some questions, but I really would like to, if I could, just for a minute. I'm not going to try to make things hard here. You mentioned that the new electronic medical record that Kaiser has put forth, and they've worked very hard to produce this system. And frankly, bits and pieces I've seen, it looks pretty good. But but what I thought I heard was that you're having difficulty with that. Do you think it's because it's a new system and you're getting used to it, or is it really going to be a system that will make patients safer and actually be a tool that in time when you get used to it will be helpful to you?
I think that the system is great. I actually was in California helping develop it. I think it's a lot different from what I saw when we were developing it in California. It is cumbersome. There's a lot of pieces to it. You've got to remember how to pull a lot of stuff into it. It is going to make patient care safer, and it is the right direction we need to go for our patients, but it is also taking us away from the bedside of the patients while we're doing the charting. So it's something we're going to have to learn how to do, and it's not going to be really quick to get comfortable with it. And the other thing is, it constantly changes because there's an update. We had downtime last night for updates, and we had downtime 2 weeks ago for updates. So,
how long does the downtime last?
We had downtime from 2 a.m. to 4:30 a.m. this morning, where we have to remember also how to go back to paper, which was not very fun.
So it sounds like it's growing pains here. This is from somebody who can barely use his iPhone, so I mean, you know.
It's growing pains. And we're also having, you know, nurses are a little bit older. They're not
young, right out of school, raised with computers. So you got it. You got to for that piece too.
So you're not able to. Now, I thought when I went on a tour at OHSU, mm-hmm. you could take the computer into the room.
We have them at every bedside.
So you can be on the computer and be in the bedside.
While you're sitting there at the bedside, you're not interacting with the patient. You're yeah. interacting with the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's frustrating when you've always touched a patient before.
No, Kathy, you can't speak from the far, but you can come up here if you want to speak.
All I was going to say is we have
some. No, don't say anything until you sit down, introduce yourself, and.
I'm Kathy Monroe again. Sorry.
Yeah.
I get very outspoken. I'm a Bostonian. Okay, gotta forgive me for that. We have
introduce yourself again.
I'm Kathy Giroux. I'm the Executive President of Oregon Federation Nurses Health Professionals, and I spoke earlier. We have somebody actually who's going to testify in detail more about electronic chatting, you know, the plus and minuses of it. I think it's not just about growing pains. So okay. It'd be good if you probably deferred to the person who will come up and actually give you a little more detail about it. That's all I wanted to say. I'll go back and I'll behave now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question focuses again on the staffing ratios in total. If we implemented the staffing ratios as recommended in Senate Bill 564, what would be the increase in nurses employed in the state?
Are you asking me?
If you've done that calculation, I'd be interested.
I have not done that calculation.
Because the average staffing ratios that you've listed are substantially different than recommended in the bill.
Well, and these ratios are all non-physician staff at the hospital, not only nurses, the data that I've brought.
Do you have, as a follow-up, Madam Chair, do you have the staffing ratios calculated that would correlate to the staffing ratios in the bill?
We have done some calculations on nurse staffing, and I don't have them with me, but I'd be happy to get those to you also. But part of the argument I wanted to bring today is that all direct patient care staff and not only RNs should be included in the bill.
Okay. All right. With that, thank you very much for coming, and let's bring up Bruce Corkum and Anna Melissa.
Hi, my name is Anna Melissa. I'm an RN working ICU at Kaiser, and I'm also the bargaining unit president for the RNs for OFNHP, the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, and AFT, Healthcare Northwest. I would like to thank you, the committee, for listening to us on hoping to get this bill passed, carried in, Senate Bill 564. It has the power to help us provide safe patient care and address the critical shortage of nurses in our state. I've been a nurse for 23 years and have seen many changes at the bedside. The face of nursing in the 21st century is changing just as quickly as the technology is. Nurses are required to learn and be proficient with all the newest and greatest and latest technology of today. One of our biggest challenges that nurses are currently facing is the implementation of electronic medical records, or the EMR, which you will see in a lot of different research and naming of this, which is at the bedside. The EMR has forced the nurses to change the way they provide care now, and has made it even more difficult to get all their work done in a timely manner. The hospitals thought that with the implementation of the EMR that they would need fewer nurses at the bedside, but that is a farce. We need more. Our hospital implemented the EMR last October, and we still have not fully reached our full productivity. We are still 20 to 30% less effective, and it's just not affecting the nurses. It's also affecting our physician partners at the bedside. We nurses have nurses that have daily incremental overtime because we just can't get all of our work done, and which includes the documentation piece of it. The MR was designed to if the EMR was designed correctly, it should allow nurses to spend more quality time at the bedside with their patients as they should be. The nurses feel that they are able to get all the work done in a timely fashion and feel, and to be able to feel good about the care that they have provided. It saddens me when I hear nurses say at the end of their shift, "I made it through the day and my patients are still alive. That's a good day." So my question is, what will happen to those nurses who are experienced and have a vast amount of knowledge and provide great patient care but are unable to keep up with this new evolving technology with the EMR in place? Will hospitals kick them to the curbside as they are unable to use the computer efficiently and effectively? Will this also contribute to our nursing shortage? Will it push more nurses away from the bedside? And we know that the computer's here and it does provide safe care. It's how do we get through the growing pains and make this more efficiently, work efficiently and effectively for those that are at the bedside caring for these patients, for our patients. The EMR has now been added to the list of many tasks that nurses need to be proficient in. We already have nurses leaving in droves due to the increased workload as they have that they have endured over the years. So let's stop this insanity and listen to what the nurses have to say about how they want to take care of their patients. Nurses are the experts, not the CEOs and not the CFOs. I'm here today to advocate for all patients and nurses. Please look into passing this bill so that nurses can provide the safe, quality patient care that every person in this state deserves.
And do you work in a hospital?
Yes, I do.
Are you a part of the committee that 2800 set
up?
Yes,
I am.
Okay. And how effective do you see in addressing the very issues that you conveyed to us?
We're working on those. I think because in our contracts that we call it a joint staffing committees, and so my hospital that I work for, we were already up and going and well ahead of the curve compared to any other of the hospitals within Oregon. And so we were already working in on our patient ratios. We have, I will say at our hospital, we do have great nurse staff patient ratios, but even with that, we're still, the acuity of our patients has increased dramatically in my 23 years as a nurse. Patients that I saw 20 years ago aren't in the hospital. They don't even get to see the inside of a hospital anymore. So we're looking, the acuity of our patients, you can have three patients, but if they're all high acuity, you have that, you know, it's a little bit more difficult to take care of those patients and to be expected to do everything that you needs to be done and feel good about the care that you just provided to those patients.
And what hospital?
Kaiser.
Kaiser. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Bruce Corkum. I'm a registered nurse. I've been a nurse for 10 years. Excuse me. I think, excuse me. So I work at Kaiser Sunnyside Medical Center in Clackamas, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, AFT Healthcare Northwest, 5017. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today on behalf of this legislation. In response to your question around how many additional nurses would be needed to fulfill the bill, what we've seen in California, we don't have numbers for Oregon, but if we kind of relate the numbers in California to Oregon, in California, the numbers grew by 10,000 nurses per year, increased active number of nurses. So over 80,000 from 99 to 2007. So there's been an increase in 80,000 nurses in California since enactment of the legislation, directly to meet those ratios, but again, also combined with it, people are actually moving back into the profession or working as nurses and because of the working condition improvement. So I believe the best way to improve the quality of healthcare, improve patient safety, improve nurse recruitment and retention, and the safety of nurses, and reduce the healthcare cost is through the enactment of this legislation, SB 564. State legislation is the only way that nurses can exert the professional control over their workloads. I don't believe the House Bill 2800 will accomplish that. Workloads which potentially do jeopardize the health and safety of patients, as well as the safety of the RNs. Numerous major studies have affirmed that the nurses, what nurses already know, that there is a connection between adequate nurse staffing and patient outcomes. I would like to mention just a few of those. Bligan and Vaughn have showed a relationship between increased nurse staffing and reduced medication errors. Kovner and Gergen have showed a relationship between the number of FTEs and the incidence of urinary tract infections, pneumonia, blood clots, respiratory tract infections. Well-known researcher Linda Aiken and her colleagues at University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing have also documented the relationship between nurse staffing levels and the and patient deaths and preventable outcomes. In fact, actually, it's estimated that there's 20,000 preventable deaths per year created due to inadequate nurse staffing. So the nursing care that we provide to our patients is often a matter of life and death. It's as reported by these major studies. Nurses work in a very unique environment where little subtle changes can in a patient's condition are the difference between life and death. If any of these go undetected, again, they can lead to expensive complications as well as needless suffering by our patients. The accessibility and availability of nurses in an acute care setting is essential to assuring the adequate protection and safety of our patients. SB 564 will help accomplish that. So how has nursing changed in the past 10 years? Work intensification for nurses has had a significant impact on the quality of care that we provide. Today's nurses are caring for older and sicker patients who require much more intense care. In the past, nurse workloads were more balanced between high acuity and low acuity patients. Surgical patients in the past used to come in the night before surgery. Now they come in the morning. Those were our low acuity patients. We don't have those anymore. The walkie-talkies that we so-called come in and they're actually don't have to do a lot for, those are a thing of the past as well. Again, we have much more time-intensive interventions than we did before, administering blood products, intravenous oral pain medications, frequent monitoring, frequent antibiotics, insulin drips, these things that we, again, and were things of the past that we do routinely now. And you end up with, again, some of these interventions on any floor that you're working on, not necessarily, so we're trying to set at a minimum standard, really, is our ratios. Why is nurse work intensification worse than ever? Patients are spending shorter and shorter times in the hospital. Americans no longer live in a traditional fee-for-service world where hospitals used to profit by keeping patients in the hospital. Instead, hospitals now have an added incentive to get patients out of the hospital as soon as possible. So this has changed in the last 10 years. We've reduced the average length of stay on most nursing units. Many nursing units now have turnover rates of up to 40 to 50% within a 12-hour period, and that's routine in some of our floors at Kaiser. Admitting discharge, why is this important? Because nurses admitting and discharging requires much more work. So that has added to our workloads. It's estimated there will be a shortfall of approximately 1 million nurses by the year 2010. Why is this? Many nurses are leaving the profession due to the decreased average length of stay, but also because of the increased information technology, as some of my colleagues have spoken about, as well as the short-sighted cost-cutting measures by hospitals that are driving nurses away from the bedside. Compounding this problem, again, is the average age of the nurse being 48 years old now. I'm not quite there, but I'm approaching that. I'll probably look my age this morning. Minimum nurse-to-patient ratios can effectively address the shortage of nurses by improving working conditions for nurses. Research has shown a definitive link between the working conditions of nurses and their overall health. Many nurses, including myself, are no longer able to perform the physically demanding work of an inpatient nurse due to injuries sustained while working in a hospital as a nurse. I've had a back injury. I no longer work inpatient care, but I did. It's had an impact on my professional livelihood as well as my personal life. There's many hidden costs to the staffing issues in hospitals. One recent study in the U.S., as Dr. Lafer has said, is that 41% of nurses are dissatisfied with their jobs, and that 43% of them felt burnt out. Many of today's nurses often discourage new recruits from going into nursing. How can the nursing shortage and working condition issue be addressed? The recruitment numbers in California speak for themselves. As a result of the minimum nurse staffing ratio legislation passed in California, nurses who have been inactive as RNs have re-entered the workforce, and nurses from other states have moved to California to continue their careers as nursing. I've actually thought of that myself. But I'm staying in Oregon because I like Oregon. I believe that legislatively mandated ratios are the only way to assure that we do not care for more patients than is safe. Firefighters have regulatory limits on how many firefighters must be on their trucks. Family daycare providers cannot take care of more than a certain number of infants and preset number of toddlers, and federal aid regulations require that one flight attendant per 50 passenger seats on commercial aircraft. Yet, we who take care of patients every single day and have their lives in our hands have no set limits. Passage of SB 564 is the only way that we can ensure our patients' safety and protect ourselves from workplace injuries and stress-related illnesses. Please support this piece of legislation.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Marissette.
You mentioned no walkie-talkies. Talk about that.
Patients who require our low acuity require very minimal care. That used to be in the hospital who no longer are admitted to the hospital are dealt with through outpatient. So in the past 10 or 20 years ago, I'd call them a walkie-talkie because we didn't have to do much. They were able to walk and talk for themselves.
I thought you were talking about communication.
So cute.
They can walk and talk to themselves, and they can also toilet themselves and do their other health care needs for themselves.
It's
I was going to add that Peace Health in Springfield at Riverbend, every person has a cell phone to communicate, and I thought you were talking about a communication device.
Yeah.
Walking. Very good.
This concludes the proponents of the bill, and I want to thank all of the nurses for coming and sharing your stories, because that's extremely important for us to know, and it is something I think that the hospitals need to keep addressing. I now need to get into the politics of something. I'd like to ask Rob and Kathy to come up real quick.
Sure. Thank you.
And as you know, there are two major nursing associations in the state. And Oregon Nurses Association, as you know, is not here. Mm-hmm. They have talked to me personally regarding this bill, and they are opposed to it. And I remember when we had our forum in Portland, where you brought a lot of legislators to share.
Which I had the video.
Yeah.
It's in your packet.
Yeah. And what I did say is that I'm hoping that you can work together.
Yeah.
And how is that going, or is it going, or have you worked with ONA at all?
Well, I've reached it out. I reached out there. The olive branch has been reached out to them. I mean, I'm being very straight out forward. I don't understand it. You know, I House Bill 2800 by itself, you know, it worries me, because I without getting too political, I don't know if the average ONA nurse represented by ONA understands that their union's not supporting this. I don't understand it, okay? I have reached out to them. That's why my first thing I said this morning was, this is not about union politics. It should not be about union politics of who brings a bill in, who doesn't. We have to work together on this. Fundamentally, it's very difficult for me to understand, Senator Anderson.
All right.
Okay.
Chair Modest Anderson, again, for the record, Rob Wagner with the American Federation of Teachers. I feel uncomfortable commenting on another organization's position on legislation. I think we're open on having additional conversation with folks. Absolutely.
That's my point. It's extremely important for me as a legislator to make sure that the two biggest nursing unions in the state come together. Mm-hmm. So when we move forward on this, there has to be some work together on this. But be that as it may, okay, we can leave that alone, but I need to bring that up. But there are some things that we want, and we are going to have the hospitals come up, but we do need to know the ratio in the last 20 years. We want to know the ratio of administrators to patients, the average length of stay in the hospitals over the last 10 years, how has it changed, the staffing ratios on that page four, the and the percentage of nurses that are in unions, and I would also like some specific information from California, if California has actually done a study, to have some real concrete studies there, and then what Senator Morse had addressed on what would be the increase of nurses if these levels were really implemented in Oregon, and I think those were the main things.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was actually taking notes, and I think I was up to 14 points on in terms of questions, and we will definitely work to see if we can get responses to the questions that have been raised by committee members today.
Excellent.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to see the OMA come here. I, you know, met with them and listened to their concerns, which were very, very general and vague, and I'm impressed with your testimony, and I tend to support what you're asking for based on the data that you've given us. So I would like to hear some compelling reasons why we shouldn't do this.
Yeah. Okay. Thank All right, you. And I think that's coming up. Evidently, there are two other proponents to the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Betty Beckham and Vicki Leach. And I'd said only a half hour for proponents, but come on up, and we'll give you just a couple of minutes, each one of you, and then we need to go to the opponents. Where are they? No, but they didn't sign up. Is that what happened?
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
Chair Monez Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betty Buckman of Portland, Oregon. I'm a certified nursing assistant, a CNA2, at Providence Portland Medical Center. I'm here to support the Senate Bill 564 and to encourage you to expand it to include all hospital staff who provide direct care, direct patient care. I've been at Providence Portland Hospital for 36 years, and each year it seems like we have more and more to do with fewer staff. I've been working to organize a union at my hospital because I want to have a voice in the staffing concerns. It is essential to include all direct care staff when setting safe staffing levels. CNAs are a vital part of the care team, and we have typically spend more time with the patient than anyone else. We are there to wash patients, to help them to the bathroom, to walk them post-surgery, and when they need help, we are the ones they call. In recent years, I've seen the duties of the CNAs increase with the new CNA2 requirements, and our responsibility are even greater. On some floors, CNAs are doing duties that used to be performed by the nurses, like monitoring fluid intake and output, taking blood sugar readings. Meanwhile, we have fewer and fewer staff. At my hospital, CNAs have as many as 19 patients to care for. I feel like we can't give patients the time that's needed to help them recover properly because we simply don't have time. I try to give each patient the attention they deserve, but sometimes patients can tell that we're overworked and will ask me how many patients I have. I have to admit that I have 10, 12, maybe 16 other people to care for when I was first a CNA, we had time to soak patients' feet, give good back rubs, or simply take time to listen and comfort the patient. But we rarely have time for that now. When there aren't enough CNAs, patients are more likely to fall or to pull out their IVs or otherwise hurt themselves. Patients will ring their call lights for help to the bathroom, and if we aren't there in time, they'll try and get up on their own. They may be elderly or confused by medications or weaker than they think they are, and it makes them more likely to fall and aggravate their conditions. It's very stressful worrying about whether you'll get to a patient on time. It's hard on those of us who have dedicated our lives to caring for others to accept that we can't provide each patient the best possible level of care. Hospital staff often get burned out and leave to work at other hospitals or change careers. Because we currently are in a hiring freeze, if somebody leaves, they aren't replaced. But the people we care for and their families are trusting us to take care of them. They put their lives in our hands, and the level of care they receive should be based on what's best for the patient, not the profit goals of the hospital that they set. I know that other hospitals have committees where everyone, including CNAs, can have input on staffing levels. I implore you to do what you can to ensure all hospitals have a fair process for setting staffing levels for direct care staff. Thank you.
And I don't know how the staff, the committee's work, we'll find that out, but I think it's important for your concerns also to be addressed with the committees that are set up under 2800.
Yes.
But we need to move quickly.
Chair Monens Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Vicki Leach from Estacada, Oregon. I've worked for 10 years as a medical assistant at Kaiser's Urgent Care. I'm here to support Senate Bill 564 and encourage you to expand it to include a wider range of direct patient care professionals. In urgent care, we all work together as a team to provide care. Each member of the team, providers, nurses, assistants, and others, has a specific skill set, and each is needed. Medical assistants provide direct care to patients. We do incisions and drainages, wound scrubbings, taking vitals, bandaging, generally interact with our patients. We're also an important part of directing the workflow of care teams in our department. We no longer see RNs doing the majority of patient care. In this day and age, especially with nursing shortage, a lot of direct patient care that used to be done by RNs is now being done by MAs, LPNs, and CNAs. That makes it all the more important that these positions be sufficiently staffed. In my workplace, we do have a set ratio of one medical assistant per provider. Ratio was agreed upon through an urgent care redesign committee and had representatives from each job class in management. Everybody was listened to and all ideas were respected. I'm lucky to work for an employer that listens to workers and takes all opinions into consideration when deciding staffing levels. Many other people in other places are not that lucky. That's why this legislation is so important and should be expanded to include all direct care providers. I applaud your efforts to address optimal staffing levels, but taking only RNs into consideration and not other people who provide direct patient care is detrimental to the patients we care for.
Thank you very much, both of you. All right, with that, I'd like to ask Diane Waldo from the Hospital Association, the Kathy Hill from Samaritan Health Services, and Carla Harris from Legacy. And then Grant Higginson.
Good morning, Chairman Monis Anderson. My name is Diane Waldo, and I am a registered nurse, and I'm also the Director of Quality and Clinical Services for the Hospital Association here in Oregon. On behalf of Oregon's 58 acute care community hospitals, healthcare systems, and the patients we serve, it's my pleasure to be here to testify this morning. And I'm here to testify in opposition of Senate Bill 564. Everyone in the room today has the same goal: the best and safest patient care. The Hospital Association strongly believes that the way to ensure this is to continue on the road we're on with the implementation of the groundbreaking legislation that was created in 2005, House Bill 2800. We're already on the right track, and it would be a shame to derail our efforts. In 2005, The Hospital Association joined with the Oregon Nurses Association to pass House Bill 2800. This new law had as its primary consideration safe and appropriate patient care and nurse staffing. This law provides a platform to do just that, to build trust and collaboration between the direct care nurses and the nursing management and administration of the hospital. The law definitely puts direct care nurses first and patient safety first. It requires that hospitals create a hospital staffing plan through a nurse staffing committee. This staffing committee is comprised of equal numbers of nurse managers and direct care nurses. And the direct care nurses are free to choose their own representatives to participate in this committee. The staffing plan has as its primary purpose the focus on patient care and appropriate staffing. The Hospital Association is working in collaboration with the Oregon Nurses Association to make the current staffing law a success. One of the most primary benefits of this law is that it really creates a structure for increased collaboration and consistent communication between direct care nurses and nursing managers. The laws have the same effect between the Hospital Association and the Nursing Association. We're working together to make Oregon's law work. And some of our efforts include a joint advisory committee to DHS to assist hospitals with enforcement and implementation of the law. And this group held its first meeting just earlier this week. We had the first annual OAHHS-ONA Nurse Staffing Summit last fall in November, where we had over 110 participants. We've developed a joint data repository, an electronic website that has a number of documents that are educational resources to help hospitals and nurse staffing committees implement the law to the best of their ability. We've also provided a sample charter to assist nurses and hospitals with the development of their nurse staffing committees. And currently we have a nurse staffing survey that is circulating to get feedback on how nurse staffing committees are working in all of Oregon hospitals. And to date we've had over 200 respondents and many more coming in every day. So with that being said, Oregon is definitely a trailblazer in this regard. Only one other state is elected to go with ratio staffing, and that is California. More states, however, have either adopted or are considering the model here in Oregon, and those states include Texas, Rhode Island, Illinois, Ohio, and Washington State. In addition, the American Nurses Association is supporting federal legislation based on the Oregon model. So I implore you to let's stay with the success story that we have here in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I would happy to answer any questions.
Let's finish the panel and then take questions, okay?
Good morning, Chairman Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carla Harris. This year marks my 40th year as a registered nurse. I've served in many roles in nursing, from staff nurse through administrative roles. I'm a past president of the Association of Women's Health Obstetric and Neonatal Nurses, formerly known as the Nurses Association of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I came to Oregon 12 years ago as vice president of Women's and Children's Services for Legacy Health System, and I currently serve as the chief administrative officer for Emanuel Children's Hospital in Portland. For 2 years, between 2004 and 2006, I also had the title of vice president of nursing for Legacy Health System. We're a six-hospital community-based system with five hospitals in Oregon and one in Southwest Washington. I'm here today to testify against Senate Bill 564. In my remarks, I will use the term professional nurses, which I define as registered nurses regardless of their educational preparation or their job class. I've attached to my written testimony the actual literature from which I will draw citations today for your information in the record. As far back as 1997, the Legacy Administration acknowledged the critical importance of participation by the professional nursing staff in decision-making processes that have impact on how care is actually delivered to patients. We set out to implement a system of shared governance, creating councils on all our inpatient units across the system that initiated as well the implementation of a multidisciplinary team approach to resolution of operational, quality, staffing, technology, and equipment issues, all of which have direct impact on the quality of care. Staff nurses are active participants and in virtually all cases are leaders or co-leaders of these councils. When HB 2800 passed in 2005, we modified our nurse staffing plan patient care policy to integrate the requirements of the bill into our shared governance infrastructure. Every legacy hospital now has an active nurse staffing committee. We are proponents of evidence-based nursing practice and apply the valid and reliable evidence available to us that focuses on nurse staffing as these plans are regularly reviewed and revised as necessary by the committees. The nurse staffing committees are constituted according to the HB 2800 guidelines with 50% staff nurses and 50% managers. Staff interest in participation on the committees ranges widely from wildly enthusiastic to little or no interest, which sometimes affects the attendance at the committee meetings. So in those instances where managers outnumber staff in attendance, the number of managers required to achieve a 50-50 attendance mix recuse themselves from discussions and refrain from voting in order to maintain the balance. Mm-hmm. Two of our hospitals, Legacy Meridian Park and Legacy Emanuel, have been challenged for non-compliance as a result of staff complaints that Legacy was not fulfilling the requirements of HB 2800. In the case of Meridian Park Hospital, the challenge came within months of the passing of the bill. DHS conducted an inquiry on the campus and found that Meridian Park Hospital was indeed in compliance with the bill. In the case of Emanuel Hospital, once again, we were found to be in total compliance down to the level of specificity by DHS agreeing with the process we have for determining the matching of voting members by staff and management categories at the committee meetings. I've taken the time to focus on this level of detail with the legacy experience with HB 2800 to illustrate a major flaw in SB 564. Specifically, Senate Bill 564 or any mandated nurse-patient ratio fails to take into account that the key to achieving best outcomes for our patients is a culture in the workplace that engages nurses in the design of systems and processes, decisions related to the allocation of all resources and not just human resources, and encourages innovation and welcomes new ideas, all focused on providing the highest quality of care possible. In short, provision of best care and production of best outcomes is multifactorial and complex, and in fact, mandated nurse-patient ratios have not lived up to the promise of the architects of this approach to improved quality. We in Legacy are in complete agreement that valid and reliable patient classification systems should be utilized to determine the care needs of patients. And where available, we should rely on the guidance of professional societies that have published staffing guidelines based on input from experts in particular specialties. Use of these evidence-based tools provides us with a scientific basis upon which we can act logically to provide the most appropriate care to patients. If we examine the California experience, which I hear has been this morning has been mentioned several times, where the legislative mandate for staffing ratios passed in 1999, and that was the first state, as you know, in the nation to do so, it is clear that the main assumption upon which that mandate is based, that patient outcomes improve with higher nurse-patient ratios, has not been demonstrated. In several studies, which I have submitted to the committee this morning, beginning with a study in August 2005 by the California Nursing Outcomes Coalition, known as CALNOC, the demonstration of the effects of nurse-patient ratios on improving quality outcomes, again, has not been demonstrated. And I would like to quote from the subsequent study by the same group. Findings reveal significant changes in mean staffing levels after implementation of ratios. Despite the changes noted in nurse staffing and licensed nurse-patient ratios, however, CalNOC's preliminary findings based on the first 6 months of post-ratio evidence did not reveal statistically significant changes in patient safety and quality outcomes. In the most recent follow-up study published in Policy, Politics, and Nursing Practice in November of 2007, that once again the same study group indicates that for their current study, they used the regulation post-regulation ratio data from 2004 and 2006 to assess trends in staffing and outcomes. Findings for nurse staffing affirmed that the trends noted in 2005 and indicated that changes in nurse staffing were consistent with the expected increases in the proportion of licensed staff to patient ratios. This report included an exploratory examination of the relationship between staffing and nurse-sensitive patient outcomes. However, the authors say, anticipated improvement in nursing-sensitive patient outcomes were not observed. For consideration in the public policy arena, the authors suggest that their findings highlight the challenge to better understand how characteristics and credentials of the direct care nursing staff, the unit microsystem, an organizational culture of safety interact to impact patient outcomes, as mandated alterations in the volume of direct care staff alone has not resulted in expected reductions in two common adverse events in hospitals, falls and pressure ulcers. And the California experiment in mandated ratios has increased patient access to licensed professional nurses in hospitals, but it has not yet improved their safety. A second study by Lang in July and et al. In July of 2004, published in the Journal of Nursing Administration, examined the then-present literature, the peer-reviewed literature, to see if it supported specific minimum nurse-patient ratios for acute care hospitals. And they concluded that the literature offers no support for specific minimum nurse-patient ratios for acute care hospitals, especially in the absence of adjustments for skill and patient mixes. These authors suggest that some hospitals seem to have other unmeasured characteristics that contribute to better outcomes. For example, changes in the work environment or changes in nursing skill mix may contribute to better patient outcomes, whether or not they are accompanied by increase in nurse staffing. I would like to encourage the committee to weigh carefully the evidence available to us that indicates the quality of care in hospitals that produces the best patient outcomes is dependent on many factors, not just one, ratio of nurses to patients. And in fact, it is becoming clearer that that one factor has not contributed significantly to our single most important goal in healthcare, highest quality, best outcomes. It is clear that quality care is more dependent on the entire culture of hospitals that value patient safety above all else and depend on and welcome the participation and contribution of the professional nursing staff in critical decision-making processes that drive health care to highest quality performance. Thank you for allowing me to share this with you this morning. I'd be happy to take questions.
Let's go through one more and then we'll take questions.
Chair Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Hale. I'm the Vice President of Patient Care Services at Good Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis, Oregon. I am one of five hospitals in the Samaritan Health Services system. I have been an RN for 40 years, and I have done most of my years at direct patient care in the hospital, and it's just within the last 10, 15 years that I have gone into management, and I still do work at the bedside. So I tried to find the opportunity to do that in order to understand what really is happening out there. But I'm here today to testify against the House bill, or the Senate bill, 564. The state previously passed the HB 2800 to establish staffing nursing committees and to break down barriers between nurse management as well as direct care nurses. And I would like to share with you how we implemented that at Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center. The mission of our staffing committee is to create strong and collaborative partnership for promoting the health and safety of those who are in our care. by ensuring that we have sufficient numbers of qualified nursing staff to take care of our patient care needs. The first thing we did as a committee was to write bylaws to help govern us. The bylaws outlined our membership. It outlined the officers, what their duties were, what the member duties were, how the meetings were conducted, and the use of subcommittees. There's equal representation between the direct care nurses and nursing management, which has really been a great strength, as it has allowed our direct care RNs to really be involved, to look at all areas within the hospital, not just those areas that they're working in, and to give input into other nursing areas as to why are you doing things, and to really question what is happening instead of just it's always been that way. So we have found it to be very beneficial. Our committee has created staffing plans. One of the first things they did is they went back to their departments and they created their own staffing plans with their peers. And they created, according to what the scope of care is, the patient population that they served, and the competency and skills of the nurses that they were working with. They came back, and yes, we do have ratios as part of our staffing levels. However, that is just one very small part. They include the acuity. They looked at the socialization issues that many of our patients have because a patient is not a patient. And they looked at the nursing skill and how could they best serve those patients that they're with. And that's how they make consideration of their assignments, and that's how they establish their staffing plans. And they did put down the minimum staffing that could be on the floor. And had various situations that they worked through, so it has worked very well for us. One of the challenges that we did work through is floating within the hospital, and that's nurses floating to other units, which is not a favorite of nurses at all. It's right up there with death and taxes. And we had a problem because our nurses did not like to float, but we needed help in other units when their units did not need the help. So we got together. The committee decided that they were going to take care to get involved and work with their peers and say, how can we make this better? And what they ended up doing is coming up with guidelines for when you float. What is that going to look like? And they also came up with guidelines so when nurses come into their department, that those nurses know what patients are okay for them to take so that we have patient safety and that they're not feeling like they're getting the hardest, they're getting dumped on, or it's the hardest patient that nobody else really wants to take care of. It has worked very well. It's been a win-win situation for administration as well as for our nurses. We no longer have them complaining about floating. We still have some bumps in the road. We have they put together a logbook where they keep track of who floats, where they float to. They put the guidelines out so everybody understands what the guidelines are when you come to that unit as well as when you go to another unit. And they also have put an evaluation sheet together so that they're evaluating each time that they go to another unit, what was that experience like. And then the committee member brings it back to the committee. We look at that and we problem solve and work through the issues. So I believe that House Bill 2800 has really helped to break down the barriers between direct care nurses and administration because we all want the same goal. We're providing safe patient care and adequate nursing staff. That's really what we all want. And I do believe that we need to continue to try to work through HB 2800. We need to put our time and efforts there. And we need to be able to resolve our challenges by coming together as a team to work it out. I thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I would be happy to take any questions.
Madam Chair.
Yes, just one comment first, though. What I really feel this committee needs to have is a list of all of the hospitals and what structure they're using, who's on the committee, how many times they meet, what changes they have made. So I would like Mr. Shook to draft a letter to the Hospital Association to then get the information from each hospital to see the pros and cons of how it, you know, the
and not just all the glamour to it, but the problems, too, that they've seen, because I think that's extremely important for us, especially since this is being used as a model for so many other states also, and I think that we need to make sure that we continue that. Yes, Senator Morrison.
Just a quick question. Have there been exit surveys of nurses who've left hospitals? I'd love to see an exit survey of why people leave hospitals.
We do exit surveys in the legacy system. I'd be happy to.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
That would be very, in fact, in that letter include if the hospitals do have statistics or data saying why nurses are leaving, the turnover rate in the hospitals. To me, in order to make policy decision, I think that information is extremely important. I've had the opportunity to go through Mount Hood Legacy Medical Center often, since that's the one in my district. So, yeah. You're done?
That's fine.
Okay, yeah.
You kind of mentioned that. I want to make sure the key thing here to me is turnover rate
yes.
in a hospital
yes.
setting. That tells me more about working conditions probably than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd really like to see that hospital by hospital. It would be very helpful.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's what we will address in the letter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other pieces of information from the hospitals that the committee would like when this draft, the letter's drafted? Thank you very much.
You.
Grant Higginson is bringing us home.
Gee, Grant, it's almost time to leave.
It was hidden. I did have this.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I'm the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. One of the programs within my office is healthcare licensing and certification, so ensuring there's high-quality care and safe environments for patients in hospitals is certainly one of the key goals that we're trying to achieve in that work. I also wanted to start off by saying that I really did appreciate the testimony from the nurses today. Being a physician, I've worked with nurses my entire career, and I was actually married to a nurse for a number of years, and so I really appreciate the critical role that they play. That being said, though, the department is opposed to Senate Bill 564, and for two reasons. The first of which is we believe that we do have a law in place right now and a law in place that is working. Excuse me. In 2005, the department and the Public Health Division was actively involved in the creation of House Bill 2800. Right after that, we created administrative rules that became effective in January of 2006. Those really were quickly pulled together, and we then spent about a full year working with the nursing associations, with AFT, with the hospital associations, and a group of other stakeholders to come up with what we thought was a really good set of administrative rules. And so we only had that, what I think is a good set of administrative rules, in effect for a little over a year, but I believe things are working. We have done the audits that are required by law. We have followed up on any nurse staffing complaints that we have received. We have gone out and found some facilities to be in what we believed was full compliance. We found some that were not in full compliance and had tweaks that needed to be done, so that we've told them that those were the deficiencies and they're monitoring to make sure that those are corrected. And in at least a couple of cases, we have found situations where we believed they were the hospital was so far out of compliance that a civil penalty was warranted, and that's what they got. So we think that the law is working as it should be. The other reason we proposed the bill is because of the cost. We believe that there would be a substantial financial impact. We believe we'd have to hire two staff in order to staff a hotline, complete investigations starting within 24 hours to complete the very complex scoring system, acuity scoring system that you would use to develop the ratios. We think this is substantial work, and we do think that there would be a substantial fiscal impact, and that impact is not included in the governor's recommended budget. The other thing that's not in the testimony, but I would like to comment on this, is the issue that Senator Bates raised about inflexibility of ratios, and I also am concerned about that. I think that from my experience, if you set a ratio that is a ceiling so that you're able to cover anything that happens, then that leads to a real waste of resources. And my experience has also been when you set a floor for the ratio, everyone falls to it. And then even if you want to increase the ratios, you may not be able to, even if it was appropriate. I also think that there can be improvements to House Bill 2800, and one thing that we have recently done is convened an advisory committee for our healthcare licensing and certification program to specifically look at nurse staffing issues and how we can improve the existing nurse staffing law. And with that, I'll close and be happy to answer.
I think it's extremely important to have AFT at the table also, so that they're definitely a part of this. And I know that the Hospital Association had mentioned, I forget which, it might have been Diane, who said that they're working with ONA. I think it's extremely important to be working with AFT also issues regarding patient care.
And Madam Chair, I will take that recommendation back to that committee.
All right. Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. We just got Vicki Leach. I did. For some reason, we missed her on the. She is a medical assistant from Estacada working at Kaiser, and she was here to support 564. I'm sorry that we didn't have you come up, Vicki, but we're out of time. And oh, did Vicki come? Oh, good, because it was the testimony was just given. I thought, oh, dear, we didn't. All right. This needs work. There's a lot of information that we need. Any other comments? With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 564, and we're adjourned.